Welcome to the Ogletree Deacons Podcast, a quick digest of compelling legal issues and practical insights delivered to you in less than 20 minutes.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining us for the Ogletree Deacons Podcast. My name is Sarah Platt, and I'm an attorney in the Milwaukee office. And here with me today is my colleague, Christine Bester-Townsend, also of the Milwaukee office. And we're here to talk with you about the one-year anniversary of the Me Too movement. This has been a really interesting time to be an employment lawyer in the United States. These are issues that we have been thinking and talking a lot about for our whole careers, but now are on the forefront of the public discussion. They're on the front pages of newspapers, headlines on social media. We're reading about it every day and are much more in the public consciousness.
Like Sarah said, we're at the one-year anniversary of the Me Too movement. The Me Too movement was actually started a decade ago by an African-American activist named Tarana Burke. But Alyssa Milano tweeted a year ago, "If you've been sexually harassed or assaulted, write Me Too as a reply to this tweet." In the 9 days following that tweet, the Me Too hashtag garnered 1.7 million tweets in every single continent. At least 85 countries had at least 1,000 Me Too tweets. And in the first 24 hours following Milano's tweet on Facebook, there was 12 million posts by 4.7 million users.
I know I had it in my Facebook feed within hours of Alyssa Milano's tweet that same evening.
Absolutely. I saw it all over my feed that evening.
And it's something that, it's interestingly, the EEOC had said until recently that they had not seen an uptick in formal discrimination complaints or harassment complaints filed with their agency. They are, of course, the federal agency that hears sexual harassment complaints. But that changed just in the last week or so.
Yes. Last week, the EEOC released preliminary data on its fiscal 2018 year. And they've seen a 12% increase in charges filed, which is just a slight uptick. The EEOC can handle Title VII harassment complaints in one of two ways. Either an individual can bring a charge, the EEOC can investigate, and then that individual can be granted a right to sue letter, or the EEOC can investigate and bring suit on that individual's behalf in their own name.
And those are much more rare, the suits filed by the EEOC, but that's where we've seen the real change.
Yes, there has been a 50% increase in the lawsuits filed by the EEOC. And this past year, out of the 66 harassment or discrimination suits filed by the EEOC, 41 contain allegations of sexual harassment.
So certainly they are responding to this cultural attention on this issue. And it's something, therefore, that employers really need to be aware of. And it's an interesting one because the underlying structure of discrimination law, Title VII, the federal law that governs these issues, has not changed. That legal structure remains the same. And there have been lawsuits that have been dismissed on the same bases that they always have, where employers have gotten a complaint internally, responded promptly and appropriately, and addressed the situation. Courts are still dismissing those claims, but there really is a change in the way that our culture is viewing these issues.
Absolutely, Sarah. While the law hasn't changed and dismissals continue and employers continue to get summary judgment in these cases, when there are bad facts, I think juries are more likely to award large damages. There was a recent over $13 million verdict out of New York on a sexual harassment case. And that defense attorney directly attributed that jury's verdict to the jury feeling empowered by the Me Too movement.
I think the Bill Cosby situation is another really interesting example. He was initially criminally tried for sexual assault, and there was a hung jury. And this was before October of 2017, before the Me Too movement. He was retried this last summer and convicted. Now, obviously, there are other variables there. They did have to present a whole new defense. But I think you can't deny that the Me Too movement has impacted how a jury might view these issues, both in his case, in the criminal case, but certainly also in civil sexual harassment cases.
So we've seen the change in terms of how we as a culture are thinking about these issues and how we're responding to these issues. I think that employees are becoming less tolerant of incidents of harassment, and they're expecting a quicker response. Sarah, have you seen that with your clients?
Absolutely. I've participated in a lot of training and facilitated a number of discussions with industry groups or employer groups. And I think that is the real shift. It's that people are recognizing that they don't have to tolerate behavior, that there is no longer the expectation that, oh, that's just how it is, that's just how he is, or that's just a cost of doing business. I think people are starting to feel empowered to say, hey, no, that's not acceptable. Everybody deserves the right to come to work and feel comfortable and feel like they have the same opportunity to succeed. And so I think people are starting to either speak up or at least think about how to speak up, how to have that conversation. I also think employers are starting to recognize that speaking up is healthy and is good. It might result in a short-term challenge in terms of an increased number of complaints or having to deal with unquestionably difficult issues. But I think many of our clients are recognizing that in the long run, that's going to be good for the company's culture. Having a culture of reporting and of communicating with more transparency is going to be for the better.
Exactly. I'm also seeing a shift in the speed with which people expect the investigation to be conducted. Many of the news stories have seen corporate heads quickly terminated after these allegations arose. Obviously, most companies cannot conduct a thorough investigation in a 24-hour period, but certainly employees are expecting a quicker response. It's not acceptable for the investigation to take a month.
Absolutely. And I think that also brings up the point that there are additional considerations now. There are the legal considerations, and you have to do an investigation just like you always have to identify those risks and address the issue appropriately. But there's also a PR piece. And obviously, when it's a media company, that's playing out in a very, very public way. But even for less media-focused companies, it's still an issue. It still is going to be the talk of social media or the local paper, or even just the employee community is going to be focused on these issues and is going to expect a very fast response, even if the law doesn't require that.
Exactly. And while Sarah and I have stated on this podcast, the federal law hasn't changed. We are seeing a lot of legislative push in light of the Me Too movement. On the federal level, while Title VII hasn't changed, this year's tax bill actually made it so companies cannot deduct sexual harassment settlements if there's a confidentiality provision in that agreement.
And plaintiffs can't either. The employee can't deduct that amount either, their attorney's fees. And so it is going to have an impact on settlement negotiations. And obviously there are other state and local laws addressing this issue as well. You've got laws that are addressing confidentiality more broadly, laws that are prohibiting or limiting the use of arbitration in the context of sexual harassment claims, and then certainly laws that are bolstering the requirements for sexual harassment training. California has long had that requirement, but has amped it up. New York has very specific new requirements, both New York State and New York City. They have model documents that they've put out, and not that any employer is going to necessarily adopt those wholesale, but they are an interesting reference to look at and consider in formulating a company's own training policies and practices.
Yes, New York is a great example of a state that really has acted in light of the Me Too movement. Earlier this year in the spring, New York mandated that you could not mandate arbitration for sexual harassment claims. But New York recently passed additional laws saying you need to have mandatory training, very specific laws in terms of what your policy requires and what the investigation process needs to be. And they did not give employers a lot of time to comply with those new laws. New York, for example, released its final models on October 1st, and gave employers just a little over a week to comply with the directives, showing that the states are taking this seriously and they're going to make employers act swiftly.
The emphasis on training, I think, is really important. It's something that I've seen employers start to recognize, even in other states that don't necessarily require the training. I think there is recognition that regular frequent training keeps these issues at the front of employees' minds. Sometimes employees just get a bit complacent. They forget that they need to act professionally. You know, you always hope to become friendly with your coworkers, but sometimes that brings a little bit too much comfort, and people start to communicate in ways that perhaps aren't appropriate for the workplace. And doing this training keeps it at the front of mind. It's also important that the training give relevant examples. You know, it's never been either of our style to do training as a legal talking head, going up there and putting the definitions of under the law on the screen. But I think it's becoming even more important, as has been my practice, to give examples, give real life examples. I always give pages and pages of examples that I have taken from real cases. They're things that have either happened to me as an employee or that I've seen in cases that I've dealt with. And the New York models talks about that, and much of the commentary talks about how important that is for people to understand the real world application.
Absolutely. I think one shift in the Me Too movement is companies, maybe in the past, were going to train supervisors, people that are the face of the company and for which liability can attach when supervisors don't act appropriately in responding to these complaints or issues. But now I think there's more companies focusing on training for their frontline workers and training their entire workforce on these issues. One really important training that Sarah and I focus on is doing bystander intervention training. Bystanders can be one of the company's strongest lines of defense when these allegations or when these incidents arise. There's times that the employee who is the victim or the target of these actions doesn't feel comfortable saying, "Hey, Jim, can you cut that out?" Or, "That made me uncomfortable. It wasn't funny." A bystander has much more power to say, "Hey, cut that out. That was inappropriate. You made her uncomfortable," etc. And I think that's a really important component of training and something that companies need to focus on. In the past, they might have said, "We're going to train our supervisors. We're going to tell our supervisors this is what you need to do if a complaint comes in, and this is how to recognize inappropriate behavior." And now companies are really saying, "Hey, we need to train all of our employees on this issue to protect the company and create a culture that makes these kinds of behavior inappropriate and unacceptable."
I think you've hit the nail on the head. I think the bystander piece really does go to company culture. And I think having people step in and let their coworkers know where those lines are is what's really going to make a difference on the day-to-day basis. I was doing one of these discussions with a group, and there was a young woman in the audience who said, "You know what? Those little things add up. Those are the things that really make me feel sort of exhausted to come to work each day." And those are the things that if you give employees a script, even, it doesn't have to be confrontational. It doesn't have to be a big deal, but just letting somebody know, saying, "Hey, man," or, "You know, that wasn't funny," or some little phrase to let the person know that perhaps they've crossed a line, that's going to help set those cultural norms and make a big difference. The other way that bystander intervention can play a big part is when that bystander is a leader in the organization. I think tone at the top is a buzzword, but it's a really important one. I think that I often see cases where people say, "Well, I didn't bother to complain because my boss was standing right there and didn't do anything." That sends the message that the company condones that behavior. So if leaders walk the walk and talk the talk, and if leaders are the ones who are chiming in as a bystander to say, "You know what, that's not acceptable," or "You've crossed a line," that can have a huge impact on company culture and hopefully nip these issues in the bud. I think the key is we don't ever want it to rise to the level of being illegal harassment. If we're to the point of illegal, we've got relationships that are irreconcilable. We've got problems that are much, much more difficult to handle. We want to catch it early when it is just a cultural issue and setting those expectations.
Absolutely. I think when you have a boss or a supervisor, even if it's a lower level supervisor, that it's witnessing maybe borderline inappropriate behavior and not stepping in and not correcting that behavior, it does become a bigger issue. And the employee feels that whatever has happened to them is acceptable to the company. And so it's so important that supervisors and leaders in the organization take an active role and step up and prevent these kinds of incidents from occurring.
And obviously, it's also important to hold leaders accountable if they are the ones perpetrating the behavior. I mean, there's nothing that can ruin company culture faster than the people at the top perpetuating disrespectful or inappropriate behavior. And sometimes it happens because those are the people in power and it's challenging. Sometimes they're the people generating revenue for the company. Sometimes they're the thought leaders or the creative leaders. And so it really is a challenge to hold them accountable, but it really has to be done. I mean, those are the times when I often and you often get involved in investigations where it's the people who are usually conducting the investigations that are potentially at issue. And so we come in and help companies wade through that and figure out how to address it. I think it's also important that people understand that even if we say zero tolerance doesn't necessarily mean someone's going to get fired. There is commentary that that actually has ill-intended effects where people don't report things then because they think, well, gosh, I don't want to get him or her fired. I just want them to knock it off. So it's important that people understand there will be prompt and appropriate action. And if that action can be a conversation to let somebody know that they're acting inappropriately and they need to stop, that might be enough. And in many cases, if we catch it early enough, that will be, that'll be sufficient.
And I think the Me Too movement obviously is still going very strong and sexual harassment continues to be a hot topic. I think we've also seen that the Me Too movement has spread to other issues outside the sexual harassment context in terms of general equality between genders in the workforce. California now is requiring public companies to have a female representation on their boards.
Mm-hmm. Pay equity is another area where it's getting attention. Some from shareholders, for some public companies, shareholders are demanding transparency and information, or even from the workforce, more analysis of what that pay landscape looks like. And I think companies are well served to do that proactively, to know what their numbers look like before somebody else asks, and to do that under privilege so that an attorney can help wade through the information, understand what it means, understand what, if anything, needs to be done about it in a way that can be kept private so that the company can take an honest look and do what needs to be done, if anything.
Right. And if the company does that internally on their own and then decides that they have a problem and they're not going to act on it, that's worse than not finding out you have a problem at all. So it's so important to conduct those pay equity audits in a privileged manner and then act appropriately so you don't have a really good piece of evidence in a possible discrimination case.
Absolutely. So I think as society continues to shift on these issues, I think there's a lot that employers can do to stay prepared and proactive. I think obviously looking at policies and agreements and other documents, formal documents that a company has, and making sure that those are continuing to be compliant with frequently changing state laws, and also with the company's norms and expectations. Make sure those policies are clear about what we want and expect of employees. I also think being prepared in terms of having your team ready to go before one of these hits. It's really difficult to get all the right people together or identify those people when you're in a crisis situation. So have that crisis team identified. Have people know if they're not on the crisis team so that they're not offended or feel excluded. Just have a plan in place.
And I think the PR and communications angle of this is particularly important because, as we've seen in the media, many of these allegations are well past the statute of limitations for sexual harassment complaints. There is no legal recourse that these people have anymore. However, it can be devastating to a company if some bad allegations go public. So having that in place, having a response team in mind to address any possible allegations is, I think, really important in light of a media that is more willing to report on old allegations.
Absolutely. So yeah, it's an interesting time to be an employment lawyer and to be running a company. I think that hopefully we'll continue to have cultural growth in this area and employers can stay proactive. And really the bottom line of all of it is to create a culture where all employees can succeed and be happy to come to work. Thanks for joining us, everybody, and we'll talk to you next time.
Thank you for joining us on the Ogletree Deacons podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts on iTunes or through your favorite podcast service. And remember, the information in this podcast is for informational purposes only and is not to be construed as legal advice.